Say one of our names. Say your name again.
4, 3.
The team.
Hi, this is Dave Schrader from Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio. You're listening to Tim Renee Graham.
Thank you so very much.
This is Mike McDowell from the Indiana Ghost Trackers and Chaos Tours saying welcome to
Chaos and get down with the sickness.
Yeah.
Say your name again.
Stop it.
Say it again.
Hi, this is Jeff Belanger, and when I'm not out looking for ghosts, haunted places, and weird stuff all over the planet, I'm listening to Paranormal Radio with Renee Graham. I never miss a show, and if you miss a show, I swear I'll haunt you.
Thank you.
That's good. Paranormal Radio, taking you beyond the limits. Sundays, 6 to 7 p.m. Central.
Simulcast.
Did you know that there is a place where strange things happen all the time? Where stories of ghosts and dark shadows are all true? What if I told you that this is a place that is really haunted? That this is a place
where the walls really do.
Whispers Estate in Mitchell, Indiana, just 80 miles south of Indianapolis. Come play with us in our huge 3,700 square foot home, where ghost children like to play, with an 8-foot shadow figure called Big Black lurks. Where the paranormal is reality. Whispers Estate. Every house has a story to tell. This one will haunt you. Visit www.whispersestate.net to place your reservation. That is, if you're not too scared to come.
Hello, all you beautiful people. Thank you so very much for sharing your evening with me, and just want to give a big shout out to all of you crawling back from Louisville, Kentucky, from the Mid-South Paranormal Convention. I understand it was a hot time, a lot of good people, and also I hope that if you went, that you were also able to catch some of the workshops, on EVP, and I understand there was also a real cool thermal imaging workshop. So if you didn't, hopefully they'll bring that around again another time. I also would like to remind everyone about the 6th annual paranormal meet and greet at the fabulously haunted Hannah House in Indianapolis, Indiana. That'll be next Saturday, which is my birthday. I'm so thrilled to be there again. And it's free. It's from noon to 4 p.m. That will be your opportunity as a team to meet other like-minded people. There will be authors there. I think Keith Age is going to pop in, and Dale Kazmarek will be there as well, both of them selling books. And you'll see Silent Phil and myself there as well. So don't miss it, and come on down. I am absolutely geeking out tonight. I have a guest that is someone that was very influential for me as a very young student in researching the paranormal. And I think that this person taught me a lot of good habits from reading one of his first books. And certainly never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine that I would have the honor of interviewing him. He is really down to earth, and I'm sort of tongue-tied. I have with us this evening Lloyd Auerbach, and those of you in the paranormal community know him as a leading expert on ghosts and psychic experience. He has a master's degree in parapsychology. He's the director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations, as well as a professor at the Atlantic University in Virginia Beach and the JFK University in California. He's the creator and instructor of the Certificate Program in Parapsychological Studies at HCH Institute. You can get that in California and also online. Thank God for distance learning. He's the author of many books, including his most recent book, Ghost Detects It. I can't even talk. I'm like playing with my hair, and I'm beside myself. Right. Ghost Detectives what?
Spit it out.
Spit it out? I can't. I cannot spit it out tonight, Phil. Ghost Detectives, Guide to Haunted San Francisco. He co-authored that book with Annette Martin, and if you followed Lloyd's work, he did a lot of work with her over the years. So if you haven't guessed by now, I'm pleased. Also, reading and learning more about Lloyd, he's a chocolatier. I mean, who would have friggin' figured? He does guided chocolate tastings, and he's also going to be selling a book called Haunted by Chocolate, How to Go from Chocoholic to Chocolate Gourmet. Lloyd, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Phil is, he's really the chocoholic here in the studio. Have you always been a fellow chocoholic, or was just this something that, like a brain drug that happened?
Well, it's kind of an odd thing. What happened I've always been, a food aficionado. And some
okay.
My wife and I call ourselves foodists.
Okay.
We're cut above. Food is our religion.
Okay.
And living here in Northern California, one of the things that I got into since I moved out here was, of course, wine. And you can't avoid that.
Right.
Then chocolate started really coming into its own here in the United States in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
Food. There's a lot more artisan chocolate makers, a lot of folks, and I started learning about it just because I was interested.
Okay.
And one of my publishers suggested I come up with a book idea, and although the publisher isn't involved with this anymore,
mm-hmm.
I came up with this idea of how I learned so much about chocolate, and that led me to interview a number of chocolatiers, famous, mm-hmm. well-known chocolate makers here in the Bay Area and a couple other places, and one of them pushed me into learning how to make chocolate. So I actually make and sell chocolate, too, just small batches and such, but that's where the Haunted by Chocolate has led to. So I actually sell ghost drops.
I was just going to say, ghost drops, I love them. Where can we get your chocolates, Lloyd?
Once the summer's over, because it's not a good idea to ship it right now, otherwise
right.
it's going to cost a bloody fortune.
Right.
My website, hauntedbychocolate.com.
Okay. So that was a real quick aside. You're also a mentalist, and you are a psychic performer. That has always intrigued me. I learned about that, in my early days, geeking out, going, oh my gosh, this guy's so cool. I understand the logical progression that, the Victorian times and, the spiritualist movement. How do you use that today? With your work?
Well, I kind of got into it because of a course that I took in my graduate school.
Okay.
Training, the parapsychology work I did. The person writing the program, John Palmer, had very wisely had us all take a course in essentially psychic fraud
taught
by a local magician. And then I enjoyed doing it. I ended up doing magic and comedy magic mostly. But learning and performing were both very important. And I was incredibly encouraged by a number of well-known people in the field of parapsychology to continue pushing that envelope, learning, performing, kind of as a side, parallel track.
Right, right.
And then eventually I switched over from magic to mentalism because it made the most sense for me. But
okay.
it helps me it's always helped me, number
mm-hmm.
one, in determining fraudulent psychic stuff from real psychic stuff. That's number
right,
one.
Right.
Mostly, though, I've used it in investigation processes
mm-hmm.
to understand how people and why people misinterpret ordinary occurrences or unusual but normally explained occurrences as paranormal ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it really helps me be a better observer and to consider a wider variety of other explanations than just psychic or paranormal ones. And then I've also helped consult with some researchers on their controls in their laboratories, just kind of avoid any possible issues of fraud there too, or sensory leakage.
How interesting. Now, do you, like, when Phil and I get married, can you come and can we hire you to perform at our wedding?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
I do private parties, I do events. Used to do a lot more before the economy tanked.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah, but I do a performance, Professor Paranormal, and it's all kind of a tongue-in-cheek, very tongue-in-cheek type of performance, mind reading and predictions and things like that.
How cool is that? Speaking of tongue-in-cheek, I've always enjoyed your drawings in your book and in your books. Something, I don't know, in reading it, you reminded me a lot of my college professors that sort of helped drive home a point, but also kind of create a little bit of levity. You know, hey, we're talking about some serious stuff here, but, you know, let's not really take ourselves too seriously. And that
really important, yeah. Yeah, I've always said I take my subject seriously, but I don't take myself seriously.
Right, right. But I think that's one of the things that I really felt a connection with you when I first discovered you for myself. That and you're very, and please forgive me for saying this if this is incorrect, but in reading your work always struck me as being very compassionate to both sides of the veil, if you will.
I've tried. That's one of the things that I've tried. And sometimes, you know, what it's really boiled down to is sometimes we sacrifice any aspects of science.
Yes.
For the motivating, I think a more motivating goal of helping the people, whether the people are living
yes.
or dead.
Yes. And that was a distinction that I think many ghost hunters and paranormal researchers they fall short of. You know,
oh, absolutely. Yeah, no question. I mean, I get calls occasionally from people who've had a local ghost hunter group in.
Mm-hmm.
And the group came in, spent overnight, after kicking them out, of course, of their house, because
right.
they didn't want family around, gathered their evidence, presented the evidence, and then left. And
mm-hmm.
the family then says, but we asked them to help us.
Right, right.
And they got no help whatsoever. It's like calling a plumber in and saying, just to see, you know, saying, you have a leak,
uh-huh.
and the plumber stays there and all it says, yes, you have a leak, and then they leave.
Exactly, exactly. So since we've already started by drawing a distinction between ghost hunters versus paranormal investigators, I asked you if there were any topics that you wanted to discuss tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely thrilled, like salivating thrilled, when you sent me some of the things that were important to you and relevant, you know, not only to ghost hunters, but to paranormal researchers, but to everyday people that just go about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you want to start? You want to start with science?
Well, I think we should start a little bit with, you know, the labels that people use.
Absolutely.
You know, the whole ghost hunter thing, of course, the term ghost hunter goes back to the 19th century.
Yes.
The fun term that was used, and it really was not intended to be necessarily a profession. Because
mm-hmm.
we don't really hunt ghosts. We hunt ghost experiences.
Yes.
But we don't hunt ghosts. And I think paranormal investigator came in because we're investigating the paranormal, and that's the thing is, a lot of times I don't see any distinction when people use those terms, because they're still following, if they call themselves paranormal investigator, and they're still following what they see on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some people who call themselves ghost hunters who are doing actual science. So I think the labels are, you have to always look past the labels of what people call themselves.
And see what they're doing.
What they're doing, yeah. Because you really mm-hmm. need to see what they're doing and how they're approaching things and see what they're actually considering. And that's just one aspect of labels that we deal with here. The other, I think the whole, and you mentioned science, and I think that's another thing. That's a label that's used. And just, it's a word that's tossed around. And this is partly the fault, I think, in the paranormal community, it's the fault of some of the TV shows. But really, it's, frankly, a fault of the American educational system. More than anything else, I think that a lot of people in the American public seem to equate the use of technology with doing science. And that's clearly in what's happened in the TV shows, and it's clearly what's going on in the community, but that's not the case. I mean, doing science does not mean you're using tools. Doing science is following the scientific method. And that's how you do science. There are tools you can use, but, you know, if you use a compass to detect magnetic fields, mm-hmm. you're not being any less or more scientific than someone uses an EMF meter.
Or a piece of string, or some powder.
Talcum powder on the floor,
right.
or whatever, yeah, whatever
right.
you're using it. I mean, people also tend to forget that stone knives are still technology.
Mm-hmm.
They're primitive technology. They're not mm-hmm. electronic, but they're still technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really the idea of using the term science. You need to know what science is about. And the websites that I've seen, some of the people I've heard talk about being scientific, they haven't a clue. They really don't have a clue as to what they're doing. And then many of the groups have demonologists on board.
That was something else I was going to bring up.
And it's like, you know, you can't be doing science from a religious perspective. It just, those two things don't go together.
Yes. Yes.
Especially if, you know, science is supposed to be, and the problem with science is science does, scientists, not science, but scientists
yes.
often have their own personal biases.
Mm-hmm.
We see that in the academic community. They refuse to even look at the evidence in parapsychology because they have prejudged it to be bunk.
Mm-hmm.
They do that, however, within their own fields with some of their colleagues. So it's not just limited to us, for sure. That's not scientific. That's actually not
right.
a scientific attitude. And
right.
actually dismissing people's experiences without any consideration of what the explanation was or even giving any props to doing any research on what might be behind people's experiences is anti-scientific, in fact.
So we actually have scientists in the field saying this is a bunch of hooey because mm-hmm. it conflicts with their own belief system.
Exactly. And that was very clear last year, a little over a year ago. Daryl
uh-huh.
Bem, who's a psychologist and a parapsychologist at Cornell University, published a paper on a study of precognition.
Okay.
Of being able, people, just average people being able to do a little bit of looking at the future and really more based on how their bodies responded to pictures they were about to see.
Yes.
And when the notice of that paper being published in a mainstream psychology journal came out,
mm-hmm.
before the article even came out, there was a hue and cry in the academic community how ridiculous, you know, basically taking the journal to task, how dare they publish this, what's wrong with these peer reviewers. There's all these comments from people in all fields of study that were being very vocal about it, and none of them had actually even seen the paper.
Well, that was my next question. Didn't they review it? Didn't they look
no.
at the data that was collected?
No. In fact, many of them actually were quoted as saying that they wouldn't even look at it even when it was stuck in front of them because it would be totally worthless, waste of their time to even review the paper.
Wow.
So that's about as unscientific as you can get. That comes from a very emotional,
yes.
belief-centered perspective. And
yeah.
that makes them no different than the true believers who, you know, will believe anything put in front of them.
Agreed. Agreed. I'm still reeling from what you just said.
Yeah.
I mean, these are educated people.
But this, you know, this happens within people's fields, within their own fields. So
yes.
there are
okay.
physicists who will not look at data in a different school of thought. So,
okay.
I mean, string theory, which is
right.
really a theory, and
right.
it's sort of even more taken to task now because of the finding of the Higgs boson particle, if that's really what happened.
Okay.
There are people in physics who just dismiss string theory ideas as bad math. And then there are people in quantum physics who have a problem with people in other aspects of physics. And certainly a lot of people have had problems with quantum physics
mm-hmm.
for a very long time. And quantum physicists are looking at issues of consciousness in relation to quantum physics, and that completely pisses off a lot of other people within that field. Then you have psychologists who have different schools of thought, and that's not even a hard science. I mean, this is another
right.
thing we have to consider.
Right.
That parapsychology is not a hard science.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's called a soft science or a social science,
mm-hmm.
because we're dealing with human experience. That means you cannot apply the same rigorous rules of phenomenal behavior in physics cannot be applied to human behavior. That's been very clear in psychology. So
right.
many physicists will say that psychology is not a science at all, and of course psychologists who are experimental psychologists will say it is, and that's a big debate there. But within the field of psychology, there are many different schools of thought, both for therapeutic
mm-hmm.
techniques and for research techniques, and they don't agree. So it's not a surprise that people argue from trying to protect their turf.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what they're doing. And we're raising some really crazy issues for many of them. Not so crazy for others, though, fortunately.
What would be some of the issues that are of concern?
Well, the main issue, frankly, is a fundamental issue in the philosophy of science, and that is whether we were dealing with only a materialist world or if there's something more.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that would shake a lot of people's worlds.
Yeah, I mean, there are, one of the big questions is around the phenomena we study is what is consciousness?
Right.
And there's no good definition for that, and then there are people in science, in all fields of science, who say that consciousness is a trick of the brain. We are just programmed to think we think. It's all meat. That's all we are. And on the other hand, then you have people in science, many people in my field, who say there's something more here. There is something beyond the brain. It may start with the brain or may not start with the brain, but there's something more than just brain that's happening with our awareness, with a variety of ways we connect with the universe around us and with each other, and that's a very, very big philosophical divide. You know, and then there's people who believe that there's something like that, that there's something more to consciousness, but as soon as you die, and consciousness doesn't survive after the death of the body, and then there are people who say that it does. So these are somewhat philosophical and scientific questions, but people will argue very, very emotionally from each side.
So in short, even if we're able to prove all of this mathematically, we will still have a group of people who have a different belief system that say, well, you know what, you made a math error somewhere, this can't possibly be proven.
Well, aren't there people who still believe the Earth is flat?
Okay.
Okay. Or the Earth was, you know, and then you have the whole creation versus evolution issue, and people believe the world was created 6,000 years ago. And, you know, there's any number of belief systems we've got here. So.
Very, very interesting. Again, you know, from my perspective as an investigator, you know, just talking to clients and, you know, all of those things, the biggest thing that I've had to tackle was an older woman telling me that the compressor on her refrigerator was actually her deceased husband communicating with her. But, you know, this really brings it all to, you know, a whole different level. And certainly in a realm where maybe I expected people to say, well, you know, we can agree to disagree. You know, we're all, you know, we all have PhDs behind our names. And I'm hearing from you that that's pretty far from the truth.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, you have to kind of change your language sometimes. I can talk to some folks who are, at the beginning are not open to talking about any of this, because a lot of the very educated people, because they've never looked at the evidence, because they've never even spoken to anyone who knows anything about it, because they mainly get their stuff from watching clips of TV or other things, they're misinformed as well. And so depending on how you present yourself and how you really use the language that you use can change the way people view what you're talking about. So, you know, one of the common terms used in the New Age world is energy. People misuse the term energy all the time. And when you talk to a physicist, you have to be careful about how you use the word energy.
Okay. That makes sense.
If you talk to a, you know, physical therapist, you don't. So I think it just really depends. You have to assess who your audience is and really be able to understand what would allow them to at least entertain the question.
Okay. Okay. I suppose in translation for me, I have a background in medical science. And in talking to clients, sometimes I find myself talking about germs. You know, instead of something that's maybe more specific or more accurate, you know, to what's actually going on.
Yeah, because people have different understandings of, you know, you can't, your doctor or your medical scientist can't suddenly talk in terms that are way above the head or outside the vocabulary of the individuals.
Right.
Because, you know, unless that's what they're looking for, there are some people who want their doctor to talk to them and make them, you know, feel like the doctor knows more than they do.
Wow. Okay. I want to get back to, and I think maybe I would also like your input as a psychologist on all of this.
Well, let me stop you. I'm actually trained as a parapsychologist, so I don't have a background. I have some background in psychology, but I actually have as much background in physics as it happens.
Okay, then that was a misconception on my part. I thought that parapsychology was something that you could get after you were a psychologist, after you got a degree in psychology?
Educationally, as it happens, the only in the UK, which is where most parapsychologists now are being trained, you typically are going to be doing a kind of a specialization within a psychology master's or PhD program. It just has fallen into that, unfortunately. And actually, parapsychology started out, and psychology were looking at the same thing, looking at the mind and phenomena of the mind. But along the way in the 19th century, they split. And psychology really looked at behavior, whereas parapsychology stayed with phenomena of consciousness. And psychologists didn't want anything to do with it. So there are many, probably I'd say more than half the people who are connected to the parapsychological community are psychology trained. But then there, but my background is actually in anthropology and parapsychology, because we actually had a graduate parapsychology program that some of us could go through for about a 12-year period here in California back in the 80s.
That was something that I noticed from your pedigree, a dog trainer, so that's actually a compliment, that is no longer available, which I suppose was sort of alarming to me.
What happened with our program actually was that we were getting outside funding, and we also had a political climate at the JFK University at the time that was supportive. And then the old university president retired, and he was the one who brought the program in at the same time that there was the companies that were funding, a couple companies were giving us funds, you know, as donation to support the program because of personal interest of the people running them, and their companies went out of business. So we had a university administration that didn't think we were of benefit to the university, and we lost our funding at the same time, and had we kept our funding, they couldn't really have gotten rid of us. So it was one of those bad timing situations more than anything else. But these days, it's impossible. It seems impossible to get a program going in any university, partly because of the academic backlash within a university, but even when you have a university, you have the accrediting boards that are one we just went through with a university I'm tied to. The accrediting board refused to even entertain a degree in parapsychology for accreditation because they felt it was too controversial.
Wow.
So when you have, you know, essentially the accrediting board not even willing to consider for accreditation, it's kind of hard to get a program going, which is why it has to hide into psychology or into something else.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. It also ties into what I was going to ask you is 20 years ago, there were not the mainstream paranormal reality shows that, from near as I can tell, the cable channels are inundated with today. I mean, I stopped watching TV when I was in college because I couldn't do that and study.
Well, just remember that 20 years ago there was In Search Of, had been on before, and of course 20 years ago Sightings was on.
Yes.
And Unsolved Mysteries was on. Both of those actually on the mainstream networks.
But very different feel, I think.
Yeah.
No question. From what in the last year I've sort of been forced to watch, you know, the Phil just looked at me and rolled his eyes. The reality paranormal TV shows, primarily because if I'm going to be interviewing people and talking to clients, you know, about activity in their homes or businesses, I kind of need to know what they're seeing, what their frame of reference is. And my question to you, I mean, we have a lot of them, but why do you think that it's so different from maybe a social standpoint? Do you think that people are maybe more faithless, or do you think that it's just like the flavor of the week?
Well, you know, the expansion of the programming on cable is completely connected to the expansion of cable shows and time to fill.
Okay, that
really
makes sense.
There's no question about that. Otherwise, you wouldn't have Shark Week on Discovery Channel. I mean, you can pick another topic, like sharks, or Las Vegas. You know, when you do a new show, a new series on the Travel Channel, at some point, the series must, this is almost a mandate within the Travel Channel, apparently, you must do Las Vegas at some point. You have to.
Okay.
Because they get higher ratings. So there is more time to fill, and this happened to be a niche that clearly had a fan base, or had a potential fan base, people to actually watch the show, and they're always looking at ratings. socially, I think what it's done is by having these shows on, people are accessing and seeing other people doing this sort of thing, and this has become a hobby. So people have been able to kind of mimic what they see on TV, because unlike Cops or shows like that, you can't suddenly become a vigilante or police officer as much as you might want to without getting into serious trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of those things that has... people have had these experiences. People clearly, so many people have these experiences.
Yes.
And the question of life after death is a major question for people. So that has nothing to do with religion per se. That's a question that people have had since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems that that's kind of spread it. The fact that people could actually mimic something and do something that they see on TV. You know, we have kids who are mimicking stuff they see on Jackass and those shows, too.
That's scary.
Fortunately, not that many, because they get seriously injured. So mm-hmm. we have mimicry happening. We always have when it comes to television. It's just a matter of this is a situation that's a little different, just what people can claim to be. And clearly, if plumbers can claim to be experts, so can anybody else.
So really what we're having is mimicking behaviors that they're seeing on TV as mm-hmm. opposed to actual education. They're learning from what they're seeing on TV. I saw a show last night. I don't remember what I was watching, and I was doing something else when I was watching it, and they had their camera system set up, and you know, there was this piece of dust that floated around, and this woman went into a 3-minute explanation, who called herself a paranormal investigator, as to why this was not a piece of dust. Why this was an energy ball, I think is what she called it.
Yeah. Well, you know, she might have been right, but it's unlikely.
She didn't have any other supporting data.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
well, that's the problem. Is that, you know, you can get all the pictures you want. It's kind of like the UFO phenomenon. The world of UFO reports, not even, you know, the sightings and stuff, the photos, they are great photos. I mean, incredibly mm-hmm. good photos, even video.
Yes.
And not a single picture, even by the UFO experts, can be declared to be a picture of an alien spacecraft or something even necessarily, you know, you can say that, well, we can't identify it, and this was nuts and bolts, because people saw it, and because it was on radar, and because three people photographed it. So every piece of corresponding or corroborative mm-hmm. evidence mm-hmm. or testimony supports that photo as being something that was real. Otherwise, all you got is a picture.
Right.
So, you know, when people, I see some of the ghost hunters on TV poo-pooing people's experiences, but that's what they're actually investigating. I mean, you have nothing to investigate.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Have an experience.
Absolutely.
There's no evidence to support it. Well, you know, your photo has no evidence to support it. If it's a photo
right.
of something that nobody else sees, you can't get a single photo. You can only get one picture of it at that time. There's no mm-hmm. other evidence that anything's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that any better than somebody saying, you know, three people in the family saying, we all saw the ghost at the same time, here's what he looked like.
Right. And the people that lived in the house prior to them saw the same thing.
Exactly.
You know, right.
Exactly.
Without any, you know, that would be your control, if you will. You know?
That's it. You need, if you don't have the human experience, preferably at the time that the physical evidence is gathered.
Yes.
But if you don't pay attention to that human experience, you're not really investigating anything. You're investigating a rumor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what a lot of times they actually do.
Why do you think that people, and I use that word very broadly, are so quick to dismiss, like you said, three witnesses experienced, you know, whatever it was they experienced, but so quick to dismiss that?
Well, I think that's where we get into the issue of the skeptics community, or, you know, who are really debunkers rather than skeptics. They're not really open-minded skeptics, or skepticism mm-hmm. is really about looking at the evidence. They don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Since the 70s, there's been a major movement of skeptics in this area and related areas, and they've kind of gathered some force in the academic world and other world. And of course, scientists are always saying, well, there's no physical evidence. That's, you can't go on anecdotal evidence, even though psychology is based completely on anecdotal
right,
evidence.
Right, right.
So is anthropology, so is
yes.
sociology. All the social sciences are based on anecdotal evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's completely dismissing human experience, but what we're actually investigating is human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So why people seem to focus on the tech stuff is because people want hard evidence, they tend to forget that we're starting with a ghost story.
Right.
And you're trying to figure out if the story is true. And the first thing you do, you've got to do, is look at the things that are reported by people and try to dissect those to look for alternative explanations. The physical evidence of anything, I mean, if you have it's like the forensic evidence of a crime. If you just find a crime scene, there's no body, there's just a little blood on the street, what are you going to do with that? There's some physical evidence there, you can test the blood, but you have no body, you don't know that there was a crime there. You need someone to say, there was a crime here, to tie that evidence to a crime or to something, to investigate what that evidence even means. But people are really quick to go for the forensic evidence, for the physical stuff, without even understanding, in the case of the tech that's used, a lot of times they don't even understand how the devices even work or what they're built to detect.
Mm-hmm. A K2 meter, I think, is an excellent example of that.
Well, it's built to detect something, it's just not very well constructed. And even the tri-field meters, all those things, they're designed, different meters are designed to detect different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. Some of them are frequency weighted to go for certain technology and others. They weren't designed to detect ghosts because we don't know what we're trying to detect.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to gather all that and see how it correlates or connects to human experience in order to see what's valuable and what is not. And just having unusual environmental anomalies, all that says is there's something unusual in the environment. You can't say it's a ghost.
Right. The thing that I think is one of the most disturbing things, and, you know, I have already told you, I'm one of those geeky chicks, you know, even as a little kid, you know, I'm saving my money, you know, not for candy or anything. You know, I was going to the library for their used book sales, and, you know, I'm buying books on mummies and ancient Egypt, and, you know, I'm not in the house playing with the dolls. I'm outside collecting bugs, you know. So I'm sort of a little strange that way. I get that. But what I'm not understanding is, and, you know, these were topics that you sent me that you wanted to explore on the air tonight, is, and I'm seeing a theme, I'm seeing a theme of people doing without understanding. And,
yeah.
And you just coined it, you know, with the equipment. They don't know how to use the equipment appropriately.
Right.
We have people that have watched, you know, three seasons of you know, a ghost hunting show, and suddenly, you know, they're making up T-shirts and business cards, and, you know, they're paranormal investigators. Where is the education?
Yeah,
where is the mentoring?
It's one of the only, and they're calling themselves professionals, which is really kind of bizarre.
Yes.
It's a fan-based thing. It's kind of like people watching soap operas and believing that, and there are people who do this, who watch soap operas and believe that the actors actually are those characters, or that their personalities are that character. Some people watch TV and they believe everything they see. Some people get into the minutia of what they see on TV, hence, you know, the famous Star Trek Saturday Night Live skit with William Shatner. And,
yes, an oldie but a goodie.
I've been in the position of, like, being with an audience of people and saying things and getting these blank stares, or people saying, making, you know, asking me idiotic questions and wanting to say, get a life, folks.
Right.
Because they buy what they see on TV as genuine, especially if it's called reality. And that's incorrect. My family, my father was a producer.
Okay.
And my uncle was a director of soap operas. And my One of my brothers is involved in TV. Another brother is involved in film. I've been around TV since I was conceived. So I know the back end of things. And I know how things are edited. I know what happens with these productions. And you can't take any of these reality shows seriously in the sense that they don't portray anything but it. Even if they portrayed things accurately, they're only portraying a piece of what was shot. Not all of what was shot. And it's what they think is going to tantalize the viewers most in any particular, or what's going to tantalize the executives at the network the most.
So basically, what I'm hearing is people are very gullible on both ends. Is that what I'm hearing?
I don't know if any of these were gullible. I think people have been trained to not question what they see on TV.
Wow, that's really scary.
Yeah, I think it's just simply the way it is. There's not, I mean, I hear the skeptics talking about critical thinking, and I completely agree that critical thinking, asking questions, is really important.
Yes.
But you have news networks who make statements that make no sense. If you ask a question, a simple question, their statement falls completely apart. So you end up with people not wanting to ask questions, or if they're told if they ask questions, too many questions, that's incorrect. But that's what science is all about. Science is not about mm-hmm. answers. Science is about mm-hmm. asking the right,
right.
questions.
Right.
So you have to be able to do that, and I mean, when people tell me that they saw a segment with me on TV and this happened in the segment, that was pretty cool, and I have to tell them that's not exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was
that's
edited.
Not exactly what I said,
right?
Either,
right.
Because part of what I said was taken out of context.
Right.
So you know, it was edited. If I'm not in the editing room, then really can't guarantee that what's being said is accurate. So it's a problem that is endemic in any sort of TV-based education at all.
Okay, wait. TV-based education? Hold on.
That's what people
hold on.
People are getting TV-based education. They're not getting any actual education.
Holy, okay. Remember, my frame of reference, my children who are now, you know, 18 and 20, grew up with TVs in the house, but no cable, no antenna. We had TVs so that we could rent movies from the library, so we could rent documentaries. We had, I hope you're sitting down, Lloyd, a library with real books in my house.
Okay.
Okay, so, you know, this whole TV culture is actually very new to me. It's something that I, after, you know, what, 25 years, am being re-immersed into, kicking and screaming, I might add. But what, TV education? What?
Well, I mean, that's where people get their ideas from a lot of times.
Oh, I agree, and I'm not challenging you. I am reeling at the gravity, I guess, of
well,
all of this.
And it's not just TV, it's also the Internet, too. I have to say, the Internet's been responsible for a lot. For example, back in the 90s, before there were so many TV shows on this subject, there was a group that started up on the Internet, and they started posting all the guy's actually responsible, more or less responsible for the orb picture thing, even though to this today he claims he wasn't. But in some interviews, he made these connections between these orbs in pictures that were suddenly appearing, and they were appearing because flashes had gotten better,
right.
Digital cameras had come in, so it
right.
had nothing to
right.
do with ghosts.
Right.
But he was making those connections between those and spirits because he was taking the pictures only in haunted houses because he wasn't showing any pictures or taking any pictures except in haunted houses.
Well, that's scientific,
could,
right?
You could find orb pictures from the UFO community. You could find them from the New Age community.
Right.
And they were interpreting them as aliens or energy beings or other things. But this
right.
guy made this illogical connection between an orb and a spirit. And because he was starting this huge Internet thing, he was able to use that and have people send him their pictures and tell people that they were getting pictures of ghosts, and that just brought people in.
It went viral, oh my God.
So it kind of spiraled. So the Internet is responsible for a lot of this stuff, too. And amateur groups, you know, I'm sad to say that my field of parapsychology has never really taken, partly because they've never had the entrepreneurship or the money, the support. To
right.
go out and do an outreach to do something more popular. I've tried to do that myself over the years. It's not always been that easy. I even had, with the production crew, we actually had a TV pilot in 93 and then again another version in 94,
mm-hmm.
which we almost had sold to a couple different networks. And we would have been the mod. I mean, we were doing the Ghost Hunter thing on TV
right.
before they were.
Right.
In the light, not in the dark.
Yes.
And we were getting phenomena, too. So that
yes.
was a cool thing.
Oh, you mean real stuff?
We had real stuff happening, yeah.
Imagine that.
But what happened was, you know, you got the Internet. You have anybody can put up a website, of course, and people will find, that's how people find ghost hunting groups, and
mm-hmm.
people make, just like they're making their claims in person, they're making their claims on the net, and there's nothing necessarily behind it other than what they mimic from some of the shows.
We're back to mimicking. Okay. I'm going to take a quick break. Part of it is... not that I'm not interested and not agreeing. I'm a little scared. I'm a lot scared, actually, that people, you know, and I'm not going to blame TV or the Internet. I don't know what really to think, except that maybe people aren't asking enough questions. They're not asking enough why questions.
That's actually right. And I love it when people ask me questions. I love it when they challenge things and we can talk out. And I've had many conversations with skeptics and debunkers, and we can talk out stuff. But when people start believing what they see on TV from people who don't have an education versus mm-hmm. someone who actually, myself or my colleagues for that matter,
and they
question us because what we say is not what they see on TV, so suddenly we're not correct, therefore, we shouldn't be paid attention to. Or we're questioning what their evidence actually is, so therefore parapsychologists should not be paid attention to. And that's happened over the last 20 years.
Probably a lot more recently than, say, 20 years ago.
Yes.
You probably had a lot more intelligent conversations with people 20 years ago than you do now.
Because the internet was just getting, the web was just getting started in the early 90s, we probably didn't have as many conversations, but we had a lot.
Right.
But the percentage was higher, yeah.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here.
Okay.
And when we come back, hopefully I'll have recovered from, everybody sort of being led into. I'm going to go off on a soapbox. Are you a music fan, Lloyd?
Some music, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I had the privilege of seeing the Roger Waters tour.
Oh, okay.
Cool. And Phil just sat back down. He's got everything queued up, and he's like, oh, no, here it goes again. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about the presentation of that show is that the imagery, the visual imagery, had changed so much. However, the message that was being given, 30 years ago? Was that when that first came out? 20 years ago, help me out, Phil. You're the music guy.
I'm not that old.
You're not that old. My ass. Anyway, there was a lot of the same sorts of things that we're talking about tonight, Lloyd, is people not thinking for themselves. People essentially being sheep, being, doing what they're told. Well, it must be right because this is what I'm told. And not asking the right questions. And
well, yeah, that's something that came out in Pink Floyd's music, and that's something that came out in the 60s just in general, yeah.
Well, I kind of missed that a little bit. I mean, I hooked on to it when I was in high school and went, gosh, this is really interesting, but I grew up in a different generation, not by much, but really the things were updated so much, and it talked about the images spoke of, big money and also, iPods and everybody plugged in and people ignoring each other. And I'm going to misquote the line, but there was a line in one of the songs that basically said, do you remember when we actually talked to each other?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm hearing here with this discussion. So now really this time we'll go to the break.
Okay.
I'll be quiet. Okay.
Lower your vibrations. Pull away's arms.
Say one of our names.
Say your name again.
4, 3.
Hi, this is Dave Schrader from Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio. You're listening to 10 Renee Graham.
Thank you so very much.
This is Mike McDowell from the Indiana Ghost Crackers and Chaos Tours saying welcome to
the chaos and get down with the sickness.
Yeah.
Say your name again.
Stop it.
Say it again.
Hi, this this is Jeff Belanger, and when I'm not out looking for ghosts, haunted places, and weird stuff all over the planet, I'm listening to Paranormal Radio with Renee Graham. I never miss a show, and if you miss a show, I swear I'll haunt you.
Thank you.
Dusty, Paranormal Radio, taking you beyond the limits. Sundays, 6 to 7 p.m. Central.
Simulcast.
Hey guys, I just wanted to share something with you. I get the weirdest voicemail. There's this, on my cell phone, I don't even know how she got my number. There's this Babaruga woman that owns this little greasy spoon breakfast place that Phil and I go to. Although I don't know that we're going to go there much longer. I ordered an omelet and I happened to walk past the kitchen and she's got freaking cats sleeping on the stove right next to where she's cooking up my omelet. Needless to say, I didn't need it. Maybe I need to even rethink the coffee. Anyway, I think she's stalking me. She keeps showing up and finding things to do. One time she even pulled up a chair and sat down with me. This was about a year ago. Anyway, listen to this. Tell me what you think.
I'm sorry I can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message after the beep.
Hey, Rini. Rini, I hear this Hannah house, this meet and greet this year gonna be on a Saturday. I gonna clear my calendar. I hear this, you know, tell me, I hear you and this Phil guy talking the other day over dinner. It's gonna be at noon until 4, and they say to come early. I think they want me to come early, and they got free things. And it's gonna be meet and greet. The meat, I don't know, maybe they're gonna have goat or lamb, and the grits is that's a southern breakfast, this stuff in a bowl, look like kind of like a dog food, but it's supposed to be good. And they're gonna have free everything, free, anybody gonna come. And the Phil, he was saying something about this psychic, and you know that they welcome. But you know, and I think to myself, Phil, why you say this psychic, they gonna know that they welcome. And then this guy was saying some celebrity, this Kit Edge guy, he's going to be there. Dale Kazmarek, he from the city Chicago area, he going to be there. And lots of surprise people, this Wanda Lewis, and they all going to be over there at the Hannah house, and everybody going to come. I think maybe you should call all your family and your friends. And maybe you gonna check it out and maybe promote it someplace, you know, in the coffee house. And maybe somebody going to overhear, like you say I did. But I did not. I was invited in the conversation last year. And I'm going to maybe going to show up this year at the meet and greet. And I'm going to meet and greet the nice people going to come out. So I think on Saturday, the 11th of August, from noon until 4, I'm going to see everybody at the Hannah house. Okay, Renee, I'm going to maybe see you and this Phil guy and these peoples in the coffee house again soon, okay? And you listen to the show on the Dead Speak Radio, yeah? Okay, I'm going to hear you on the radio. Bye-bye then.
Did you know that there is a place where strange things happen all the time? Where stories of ghosts and dark shadows are all true? What if I told you that this is a place that is really haunted?
That this is a place
where the walls really do totally.
Whispers Estate in Mitchell, Indiana, just 80 miles south of Indianapolis. Come play with us in our huge 3,700 square foot home, where ghost children like to play, where the 8-foot shadow figure called Big Black lurks, where the paranormal is reality. Whispers Estate. Every house has a story to tell. This one will haunt you. Visit www.whispersestate.net to place your reservation. That is, if you're not too scared to come.
Here we are with Lloyd Auerbach, and basically, he's scaring the hell out of me tonight. I don't know if that was your intention or not.
No, not at all. It's certainly attempting to scare you in a completely different way than people might think.
It
Exactly. Ghosts don't scare me. Things that go bump in the night, unless, of course, they're spiders. But I'll say it out loud, the stupidity and gullibility of the American public. How does that sound? A little harsh.
Well, but. You know, let's say, you know, I grew up around TV, and I grew up in a way that a lot of other people didn't, because my father worked for television.
Yes.
So I knew what was real and what wasn't.
But it's changed, you know, hasn't it, since you were little?
Excuse me?
It's changed, though, hasn't it, since you were little?
You know, some of it's changed, certainly.
Okay.
I think that there have always been sort of reality shows, different types, and they certainly have changed, partly because the writer's strike, I think, back in the 80s really kind of shifted things quite a bit more than anything else.
Okay.
But, you know, it's really, I think a lot of the dramatic shows haven't changed, other than, you know, there's different trends that kind of fall into those.
Okay.
And movies, you know, movies have always had this thing of claiming sometimes that something's based on a true story, and they've always taken dramatic license with it.
Right.
I think it's gotten to a point where now a TV show, you know, there was a show back in the 90s called Psi Factor, which was a dramatic show, it was based on the supposed research and investigation by a group called the Office of Scientific Investigation and Research that Dan Aykroyd's brother Peter was involved in, and a friend of mine was involved in. It was sort of really there and sort of not. There's a little bit of fluff around that story to begin with, but they claimed that the story, at the very beginning of each episode, they said that the story is based on actual reports to the Office of Scientific Investigation and Research. And what that suggests to most people is that the story is true, or is based on a true story. But what it really meant was, somebody would call their office line, it would report seeing mutant alligators in the sewers of New York, and they'd kind of would not investigate it, but it wouldn't matter. That's a report. So the report was real.
Right.
It wasn't necessarily, and it was true as far as the person reporting it might have been concerned, but it wasn't necessarily a report that panned out. But that became the inception of the idea for the episode script.
Okay.
So you can fudge the truth thing quite a bit. You know, I see a lot of things on TV now called saying that it was inspired by a true story.
Right.
And what does that mean? It just means that they've taken one plot line and they've inspired to write a story about it. And actually, most fiction is inspired by true stories, even true characters in some way.
No, I agree. I think one of the things that before we talk about paranormal unity or non-unity, wanted to touch a little bit on the misuse of labels like science and scientific and debunking, but how that has taken a completely different animal in and of itself, if you will, based on, you know, again, what people are watching. And not just one TV show, but, you know, there's so many.
Yeah, and you know, you see these people on TV, and they all talk about doing scientific work and stuff, and the principals themselves, the ghost hunters themselves on these shows, aren't trained scientists. And with some of the shows sometimes bring in experts, but most of the shows do not want to bring experts in because they don't want to have their main characters disagreed with.
Yes.
Or contradicted.
Yes.
So Ghost Hunters does not bring in experts. Paranormal State did, sort of. But they edited the show in such a way that it wouldn't matter what the expert said. It would, you know, I stepped away from doing that show. I was asked a number of times because I was afraid how they'd edit me and what it would say, you know, because it's so much of a demonic focus on so many of the episodes. So you have this situation where the reality shows, people should be asking the question, why are there not people from the field of science in these shows or advising these shows? I mean, that's the first question that somebody should ask who's truly interested in the science of what they're seeing on TV. Or at least some scientists should be advising, even if it's not a parapsychologist, somebody should be talking to them about the way science actually works.
So scientific method. I don't see that.
Yeah, and the debunking thing is really, that one drives me absolutely nuts because it's just been taken up by, and it's because of Jason and Grant, because of their show. They started using that term regularly whenever they tried to explain something. But that's not what debunking means. Debunking means assuming, you know, not only explaining, but coming up with the explanation of how it's been faked. Because debunk comes from the root bunk or bunkum, which means con or con artistry.
I did not know that. Okay.
So when people say that they're going to debunk something, they're going in, you know, if they knew what the word meant, they're going in to come up with how it's being faked, mm-hmm. or why they're being lied to, or how they're being lied to. What they should be doing is what scientists do, which is try to explain or understand what the mm-hmm. phenomena is and mm-hmm. explain what might be going on.
And reproduce it.
Yeah, that you go in to explain, you don't go in to debunk.
Right, okay.
By the way, I just mentioned that I was with a local group from the Bay Area
yes.
where I lived here on a case. They invited me along, and they introduced people on their team. This is another thing these shows have done. It's, you have the team role. So there was
right.
the tech guy. And,
right.
and then they said, this is our team debunker. And the woman, who was a fairly well-educated woman, she flinched. She was already introduced to me, and she pulled me aside and said, do they not believe me? That's what she said. And then on top of that, the team debunker was also the team sensitive, which any debunker in their right mind would just roll their eyes at.
I'm over here making this really strange face. I can just see myself in the laptop screen. And yeah. Huh. That's
again, people don't, they're just using the language, they're using the jargon without, it's like in the New Age world and the world of the true believers, they use the language of science sometimes. You can go to a New Age convention. I remember going to one, a big one here in the Bay Area, the Whole Life Expo back in the 80s, and seeing people touting, you know, different kinds of healing, and somebody was selling tachyon healing. And I said to them, do you know what a tachyon is? And the person looked at me and said, no, I actually don't. I said, do you know why the people who are running your business have come up with that? He said, no, it's probably because they're using tachyonic energy, but I don't know what it is. I said, a tachyon is a particle that's been theorized to travel only faster than the speed of light, not slower.
And what was their response?
It still hasn't been proven to exist. So here they are claiming to be using tachyons when tachyons are theoretical, cannot travel slower than the speed of light, and could not possibly have been part of the energy that they were using. So people just like to use jargon because it sounds cool. I mean, you know what a quantum leap is?
To be honest with you, I've read about it, but I've never actually played one on the radio.
Yeah, well, Quantum Leap is, of course, which is the name of a TV show. And when people talk about taking a quantum leap in science, the problem is that the quantum world, is the smallest possible particle or distance that we can possibly measure. So a quantum leap would be the smallest leap you could possibly make.
Which is the direct opposite of what people are insinuating when they're talking about quantum leaps.
That's correct. But it sounds cool.
Well, yeah, you know, when I was learning to dive, one of the things that my dive master said is, it really doesn't matter how cool you look, but it matters how alive you are at the end of the dive.
That's good advice. That's very good advice.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. But I'm sort of seeing a lot of parallels with that.
Yeah, actually, that line is that kind of is apropos to people's. One of my other big bugaboos is these groups talking, going into clients or people's homes and claiming that they're. And I've seen claims on their websites of being completely confidential, keeping everything confidential, and then they show pictures of the people. First of all, they show pictures of the house on their website, and they show pictures of the team all wearing the same T-shirt, and they have a big sign on their van or cars. I don't know how
that's subtle.
Confidential.
Yeah, that's real subtle, Lloyd.
Yeah.
What about methodology? The methodology of what people are mimicking from TV, because that's what they're learning, versus methodology of actual researchers?
Well, again, we have to separate, when we do cases, we have to separate the needs of the family versus the needs of science. And just keeping that in mind,
yes.
The piece that's missing for both of those fronts is an extensive interview process. Because you want to actually focus on what's happened. You interview every individual in the family or the location. You interview them together. You interview them separately.
Yes.
You ask them the same questions more than one time. That's what any investigative journalist would do. That's what any cop would do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what any investigator does. You just need to do that. And that's a piece of the methodology that we rarely see on television. And some of that's going on behind the scenes because the production people are sometimes interviewing the people so that they can figure out how to frame the show.
Right.
But that piece is often missing completely. The other thing is it's really difficult. It's next to impossible, in fact, to control a natural environment, somebody's home,
mm-hmm.
for a controlled study. I mean, you can only take science and apply it so far in an environment that you do not have complete control over.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to make conclusions, draw conclusions from the data you gather, given that particular circumstance. And of course, based on the history and understanding that the field has gotten so far about how these phenomena behave. And sometimes it's not, sometimes you come up with a big question mark. You don't really know. You can say it can be this, it can be that, and you're not really sure because it hasn't happened in front of you. So you really don't know what could be responsible for it because it could just be a trick of the of misperception or something else that the family's got.
And also, from my perspective, something that I keep coming back to with scientific method, it's really hard to get reproducible results.
Well, when you have people's behavior,
yes,
it's really hard to get reproducible results, even amongst the best athletes,
yes,
who do really well. That's very, very difficult. It's the replication rate in psychology experiments is pretty low because of that, and that makes sense because performance issues come in and individual personality issues come in as well. The only place you might get reproducible results, or theoretically should get reproducible results, in the phenomena we study in people's homes is what we call residual hauntings.
Yes.
Because psychologists have to be able to interview people and identify the pattern to see if you can be there when the pattern happens again. And then also be there when the pattern doesn't happen, and then use your technology to see how the two things compare, because that's important too.
Again, using science instead of,
And you have to have a control on a scientific research project.
Okay.
And the control would be, this is a time that nothing ever happens in the house. So let's see what readings we get. Let's see what kind of, let's bring in a psychic and see if they get anything right now. Let's bring in some other people and see if they pick up anything up. And let's bring them all back at the time that this phenomena actually is reported happening and see what the difference is.
Okay, well, I'm guilty of that. I am guilty of not going in and doing a control. Okay. What advice would you give to groups that would like to actually step it up a notch and do what they're saying they're doing?
Well, one thing I would say, and this is for everybody, is everybody who calls themselves a ghost hunter is involved in this has got to have some curiosity about the subject, I would think. And I think that they need to indulge their curiosity. That means asking questions. So I would, the first thing I would suggest is that people start looking at the history of the field, whether it's parapsychology or even going back to our predecessor, psychical research, to look at the history of investigations and research of apparitions, hauntings, poltergeists, and such, which go back 130 plus years. And the good news is that for the last several years, you can get free literature. A lot of the early books before 1923 are uploaded on Google Books. The best place to get them, I think, is archive.org.
Archive.org,
and you have to search. You can search the word ghost, but it helps to search the phrase psychical research. So it's psychic AL. So psychical research is a good phrase to search because they're not all tagged properly, unfortunately. But you'll find the journals and proceedings of the early American Society for Psychical Research and the British Society for Psychical Research, much of which includes field investigation stuff. You'll find books on historical ghost hunters. You'll find material about spiritualism, about mediumship, about psychics, about research, early research, about applying science to these things, the seance room and understanding this stuff, about photography. There's a book, there are books that have spirit photographs in them.
Yes.
Which you can get for free. So there's a, several hundred of these.
Okay, I've been buying this stuff all these years and it's free.
Well, yeah, now it's free. I've been buying it, too. I have some books I've spent a lot of money on.
I don't feel like such a dork.
But frankly, I've actually, because both Amazon and Barnes & Noble offer many of these books in Kindle and Nook form, you can download them to your e-readers as well. And usually, I think that archive.org often has the material in that format, in one of those formats, too.
Oh, cool.
Format.
Cool.
So that's one thing to start. And the other is to really look at the field of parapsychology. Because, you know, a good place to start would be the Rhine Research Center, which I'm on the board of.
Yes.
And it's just Rhine, R-H-I-N-E.org will take you to their website. And they have educational programs. They have many of which are online. They, we're hoping to do a lot more that'll get more material out to people as well. But that's the research lab that's been doing stuff. And while they focus mainly on laboratory ESP and laboratory psychokinesis, they still have done some other work as well. And then there's organizations like the Parapsychology Foundation, which is parapsychology.org, mm-hmm. which has incredible educational materials in their Lyceum site. Bibliography is a great stuff to read, including on apparitions and all this other stuff. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of great information. My website has a lot of articles that I've written over the years, all available for free for download.
Now, that's not your Haunted by Chocolate. That's
No, this is my mindreader.com, yes.
Mindreader.com, okay.
Mindreader.com, right. And then also, you mentioned my courses.
Yes.
I offer distance learning courses in a couple different formats. They're actually going to be offered online very soon through BTVN, but right now they're MP3-based with a lot of other material, and personal contact with me, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I do with all my students, is have some personal contact on the phone. But people can take some basic courses. There's a number of different educational opportunities just to learn some basic stuff. There's a lot of free stuff out there. And that's the thing, is if you start with the main folks in the field, then mm-hmm. you'll get to the right kinds of sources. And it's just really about indulging your curiosity and expanding mm-hmm. your awareness. And yes, it's a little harder to do scientific methodology than it is to walk around with meters and just simply, you know, play, which
right.
is what a lot of people really seem to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you, getting the ghost story, if you're not interested in the ghost story, then what in the world are you doing? That's what I can't quite figure out. If somebody, these people seem to want to run around these places, like these haunted prisons and stuff, and get some really cool EVPs and get some readings on their meters, but they're not interested in the story.
Okay, I'm the geek that's showing up early at Mansfield and Moundsville with
mm-hmm.
my 35mm camera taking pictures of the architecture and going, when was this built? What's the oldest part?
Like that.
Yeah!
Yeah!
And I don't get it when people don't get it.
Talk to people who work there and see what they have to say about the place and
right.
about the hauntings and such.
Right.
That's really important. You know, I've been to places where when people have asked me for some conferences, and possibly one of the reasons why I don't get invited to conferences is when they've asked me to lead an investigation, they say, well, that's fine, but here's how I want to do it. They say, well,
right.
no, these people want to be in the dark. And I say, well, I'm not going to work in the dark because, you know, there's nothing to do.
That
so
was...
if they just want me there to hang out, that's fine, but don't say I'm leading an investigation. But one of the things I always want to do is I want to be able to talk to witnesses.
Yes.
Who do you have, even if it's written down, just what do you have
right.
that says that there actually was something that happened here? Rather than just a legend. Who do you have? And if I'm told that, you know, there's nobody, it's like, why are you doing the investigation here?
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that Phil had while we were on break, and we each have our own opinions, but you clearly have more education and more experience in this field than both Phil and I together. He wanted to know what your opinion was of ghost hunting in the dark, ghost hunting during the day. Do you see a difference in the occurrence of paranormal activity?
Well, if you look at the reports, the actual reports going back hundreds of years, but the better reports are actually gathered since the middle of the 19th century,
yes.
you find that people have ghostly experiences at all times of day and night.
Mm-hmm.
More often when the lights are on. So it still could be at night, but the lights will be on.
So you can see? Is that what you're saying?
No, because that's when you're awake.
Right.
Middle of the night, most people are not awake, so unless their relative who just died, and that's the other thing, is 99% of ghost experiences happen because someone has just died or within a couple days, and they're showing up to say goodbye,
mm-hmm.
or to tell you that they're okay, or to deliver some message, and then they disappear. And that could happen in the middle of the night because that's when the person died.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, the phenomena happens at all hours of day and night, depending on the individual who the ghost is, but more importantly, depending on the phenomena. So if the event that is recorded into the environment, if the imprint
yes. Yes.
of an event that happened at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, then that's likely when the event's going to be reoccurring. It's not going to happen at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's going to happen at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But if the event that was recorded happened at 3 o'clock in the morning, that's when it's going to reoccur. Whether anybody's going to be awake enough to hear it or
mm-hmm.
experience it, that's a whole different question. And you can have the lights on, because light makes no difference whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
clearly,
mm-hmm.
to these experiences. Light just makes it, you know, the reason why the lights are out on TV shows is because of night shot cameras. If there were not consumer night shot cameras, I can tell you this, having worked with TV back in the 90s,
uh-huh.
there would not be dark lights out on these ghost hunter shows because they wouldn't be able to show anything. It looks a lot spookier with infrared. That's the whole thing.
Right. And Phil and I are over here nodding, and I'm thinking, you know, I really can't see a damn thing. You know, can't we just turn the lights off? The ghosts don't care.
Now, if the phenomena only happen to the family or the people in the environment when the lights are out at a certain right. time, then yes, you would try that. No question. You would definitely do that. But it doesn't make any sense to do it just because you think that ghosts come out in the dark. That is folklore.
Yes. So you're saying it depends. It depends on your research. It depends on interviewing the witnesses. It depends on each individual situation.
That's correct.
Okay.
No, there's no blanket here. And,
no blankets.
Although I will say that the majority of cases, you do not need to turn the lights out.
Thank God. Thank God. We're right about something, huh, Phil?
Yeah.
And by the way, those infrared night shot cameras still work in the lights.
Yes, they do.
You still make people look spooky when it's light, but, you know, then you just can't stumble on things, against things.
Oh, man. Man, oh, man, oh, man.
And you got color.
What?
And you got color.
And you got color.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Wow, we're doing science again.
Yeah,
that's the second time tonight?
Yeah, you're right. I think the color thing's important. It's almost like doing the night shots a big step backwards towards black and white. Or in this case, it's black and green.
I know. Want to talk a little bit about technology being misinterpreted and applied incorrectly. You know, and I think the night shot camera that you brought up, you know, maybe that's not an incorrect use of it, but, you know, maybe it's not necessary.
Incorrect use of it is when you say that you see shadows on your night shot, and clearly there's nothing casting a shadow.
Right.
Because it's infrared.
Right.
The problem is that the light from your infrared camera, because there is light being projected like
yes.
a spotlight,
yes.
actually casts shadows. And an easy way to show that that is the case is if you're getting some sort of weird shadow on your infrared, use an infrared flashlight. Easiest, cheapest one to get is a universal remote control for a TV set.
Okay.
That's an infrared. It's like a little flashlight. So if you got a shadow on the video, the viewfinder, you take one of these things and you shine it in the spot of the shadow, and the odds are that shadow will completely disappear like you would as if you use a regular flashlight. It's just it literally is a shadow. So that's one piece of tech that's a problem. In some respects, all the meters are a fundamental
yes.
problem that we have in parapsychology is that when you've got, let's say that we have an apparition, we have a ghost in the room.
Yes.
Okay, and we don't really know that the ghost is affecting the electromagnetic fields. We don't know
right.
that for sure. We're,
right.
we're assuming that because the meters go off. The problem is that if a ghost were to move something, the only way ghosts can actually physically move something is if they had the ability, which we all do have, called psychokinesis. It's a mind over matter effect, because a
yes.
ghost doesn't have a body, a physical body to pick something up or to move something.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that people, living people, can affect technology with PK. We've
yes.
got tons of research on that. We assume
yes.
that ghosts can do that because you do have electrical effects on other things
mm-hmm.
and physical object movement in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really know when that little needle on the EMF detector moves whether or not it's the ghost mentally flicking the needle rather
mm-hmm.
than causing an electromagnetic field.
Well, what about one of us flicking the needle mentally? I mean, if we're going to go there, right?
I'm glad you brought that up because that's also a big
mm-hmm.
problem that's called the experimenter effect, and
mm-hmm.
that's responsible for an awful lot of what we get for EVP, most likely.
And that was the next thing I was going to
yeah.
talk about was, you know, what do you think about that? And we'll take it one step further with photography.
Sure. Well, you know, with EVP, we have an issue. You know what? We might want to take a break because it looks like my phone's about to get bad enough to switch phones here.
No, we can take a quick break. I wasn't quite done with you, but yeah, we can
take a quick break.
Okay, thanks, Lloyd.
All right, and I'll have to call you back.
Okay, we can do that. We talked his phone to death.
Yeah, I think so.
Lower your vibrations. Pull away his arms.
Say one of our names.
Say your name again.
4, 3.
Petunia.
Bad guy.
Hi,
this is Dave Schrader from Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio. You're listening to 10 Renee Graham.
Thank you so very much.
This is Mike McDowell from the Indiana Ghost Crackers and Chaos Tours saying welcome to
Chaos and get down with the sickness.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry about that.
That's okay. Phil, fade us out. Okay, here we go. No, that's okay. We talked your phone to death.
And, yeah, well, I had been on another show earlier, and I guess I didn't charge back up or something like that.
Well,
we're talking about technology when that happened.
That's funny. That is funny. But I am glad that you didn't say, oh, I'm sorry, my phone's dead, and you didn't want to call back. So we're talking about EVP, and we're talking about you had a scientific name for it, experimenter.
Experimenter effect.
Okay.
It's the idea that, you know, we as experimenters, in an experiment, any experiment you've got, for example, a psychology experiment, the experimenter
yes.
does have a psychological effect on the subjects.
Yes.
In parapsychology, because of this possible issue of psychokinesis, it could be that any positive results come from the expectations or desires of the experimenter and not
mm-hmm.
from the subject who's trying the test.
So how do you double blind that bad boy?
We avoid the issue.
Okay. An honest answer.
Well,
I love it.
All we can
it.
Say is that PK is happening here. It's actually happening. That's a good thing.
Okay.
Necessarily, and we hope that it's just the subject and not us.
Okay. So you punt, right?
So with the EVP, one of the things that I've noticed over the years, several of my colleagues have also, you know, EVP is an old thing. It's been going on since early 20th century. There are certain people in these groups that seem to be the only one to get EVP
exactly
every single
yes.
time.
Yes.
So what does that say? That says one of two things. Either they are doing it themselves unconsciously,
mm-hmm.
or
a vehicle.
It may be that they are without realizing a medium.
Right.
A new kind of medium.
Yes.
That the spirits need to connect or the environment needs to connect to the
mm-hmm.
device with them.
Mm-hmm.
And either one, you know, both of those things should be researched. I think that in itself is a really interesting effect. But when you mention to people that they have something to do with the circuit, so to speak,
yes.
or that they may be causing it, people freak out, like my researcher colleagues would. You know, that nobody wants to believe that they're causing it when you're looking for some other cause.
Clearly, that's why you're a scientist, right?
Gotta ask those questions.
Right, so that you can be on the outside of all of it. You certainly
exactly.
don't want to be
observer.
On the
you don't
want to
be the person causing everything, making it happen, right?
No, I've wondered that myself, you know, from field experience. I mean, clearly I'd read about it before I went out into the field,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, some of the EVP I've collected over the years just didn't fit. And it's like, you know, this doesn't fit anything. And
yeah.
it certainly mirrored, you know, some of my own expectations, you know, or excitement, you know.
Yeah, and the thing is that in any given session, some of it could be you, some of it be you and a ghost,
uh-huh.
and some of it you and the environment, because some of it may be imprint that's coming through you.
Yeah.
Some of it may be the ghost alone. So it's kind of hard to know because we don't have a directional detector, so to speak, of all this stuff.
But it's still cool.
Yeah.
Cataloging. I mean, what's up with that? Why do we have, as a community, such a difficult time getting together and cataloging all of this?
Well, I think in general there's no place for people to report their data.
Yes.
Yes. On top of that, you know, even if you reported the data, you need some structure to actually do something with the data. I know some people have tried to do that and tried
yes.
to create places, databases to put that up. It's very, very
yes.
difficult to get a lot of this stuff in. And then there are people who are just very jealously guarding their data. You know, they like there's some people jealously guard their territory. There are ghost hunter groups, as you
right.
probably know, that
right.
seem to think that certain areas of a city are theirs, and if any other ghost hunter group comes in, it's kind of like a gang war. So it's kind of a crazy... Jeff Belanger and I have talked about writing a musical called Ghost Side Story.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it gets to be, you know, they're wearing their colors and they're
mm-hmm.
tagging areas. It's just kind
yeah.
of crazy for some people. But that's one of the problems there. And there, these conferences, people don't talk about what they're, even in conversation, don't talk so much about their findings. They listen to para-celebrities.
That is something I've seen a huge push for in the last 5 years. I mean, more so than prior to that. I mean, maybe because there weren't as many paracelebrities
prior
to that. But, you know, it seemed like there were more researchers, there were more people that were being invited to conferences going, well, I've worked on these five gadgets over the last 3.5 years, and this is what I found, and, you know, why don't you all step up and, you know, maybe poke at them and see what you think? And I'm not trying to downgrade it. I mean, I'm not very, I can make a Frank's box, you know, if I have a plan and all of that, but I'm not nearly creative enough or knowledgeable enough that way to, you know, say, oh, if this, why not that sort of thing, you know, in that realm. So I'm not trying to downgrade the people that are doing that, but I'm just saying that it's very, very different. And it seems to be the exception rather than norm now for a quote-unquote paranormal convention to actually have a workshop.
Yeah. Workshop or anybody who's been in the field at all, you know, there are exceptions if they happen to be in a local area and there are local experts. I think that makes it a little easier because the economics of these conventions has changed quite a bit, too.
Oh, my God.
And it's partly the celebrities who charge a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, it's partly because it seems like people only want to go to these conventions if they're in a haunted venue.
Mm-hmm.
And those venues have now started charging thousands and thousands of dollars. So in order to have these haunted venues, to have a successful convention, you have to go to a venue that may be charging you $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
You have these paracelebrities who are charging $7,000 to $10,000 a piece.
Sometimes. Is that what they're charging?
There are a couple who charge $7,000 for a lecture. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I'm not cheap, but I'm not that expensive. Compared, in fact, probably in some instances, it's more expensive to fly me cross country than have me speak. So. You have to look at there's a lot of economics here, and there's never a guarantee that you're going to get people to show up. So a lot of these conventions, you know, they charge like $300 for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you look at what they're paying out, they're making very little money. I mean, these are often
right.
The people making money are the big speakers, the top speakers, and the location. The location's making quite a bit of money. And I think that considering the fact that some of these places wouldn't even be in existence anymore except for these groups, they're really doing a little price gouging here.
Okay.
So, you know,
I'm glad you put that out there. I mean, I'm glad that you're speaking your mind. I personally don't have a problem with supporting historic locations. I mean, in order to keep their doors open.
I don't either, except when they're in favor of, you know, when people are putting all their energy into that and they're completely ignoring historic locations like the Ryan Research Center.
Okay, fair enough.
And the Society for Psychical Research. So, you know, mm-hmm. I get requests all the time from people saying, we want to do an auction and offer something of yours. You know, will you donate something? And now I'm donating pictures. I'm not donating any books or anything else anymore because anything I do is for the Ryan Center or some other place. I can't afford to give people books all the time, especially when they're, you know, turn around and say, we can't have you at our convention because we can't fly you here.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can't, you know, support, we're not even, and some of these conventions don't even bring in any expert, anybody in the field. They're all paracelebrity people, so I don't feel obligated to support those things anyway. I have other historic, I have locations out here I'd like to support, like the USS Hornet Aircraft Carrier Museum that I support.
Yes.
So, it's great that they're supporting historic locations, and I think that's a great thing. I think that those locations are turning around and gouging those people. They're not really working with them. They're working not against them, but they're using them as a way to get more money without seeing how that they might actually come up with other ways to bring in more people to support the location in a normal way.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, all these folks who are saying that they want to support the paranormal community are completely ignoring the folks who've been doing this for a really, really long time and who need the support more than these locations do.
I think that is very, very well said, Lloyd. I do. And it's sort of a sobering, you know, concept that what is popular is being taken as being more real than what is really real.
Yeah. Yeah, but that just seems to be, I mean, it's been that way around other areas of science and other areas of human endeavor in general. So,
do you see things changing? Do you think that that the reality TV shows, do you think that they're going to no longer be our viewers darling and fall off?
Well, I'd say that, you know, there certainly have been shows that have fallen off the face, but the networks keep trying, and they
right.
keep they constantly. I work with production people quite often over the years.
Yes.
Can't tell you the number of shows that have been pitched that haven't gone because the pitch was invited. And here's the thing: the pitch is invited because they want something different.
Right.
They don't want to do Ghost Hunters anymore. Well, let's do something different.
Right.
And work with the production company. You submit something. They turn around and what do they do? They bring in a show and said, "Now we're going to go with these guys," and it's exactly the same as Ghost Hunters or the other show.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So the TV folks are afraid to try something. This is not just in the paranormal world. This is just in general in television.
Okay. Okay.
That a lot of times networks are not willing to take a chance on something new because they know what works. This is because the advertisers say, well, let's just keep to what works. So, it's all driven by money.
Right, and I keep waiting for the wave to crest, as it will, and fall back and for some normalcy to return. But it looks like I'm going to wait for a while.
Yeah, I think it's going to keep going the way it is. I think until... I don't know, until there's a rash of comedy shows making fun of it on the main networks, like a sitcom or something like that, I think it's not going to change.
So what are you doing next summer, Lloyd? I'm kidding. That was a joke. We can make our own documentary comedies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, okay. It's a bad
joke.
Yeah, no,
I'm kind of hoping, working with a couple of producers, we may even do a Kickstarter thing to do an actual kind of a show. I've actually got a web-based kind of clip show, basically it's short webisodes that hopefully we'll be getting up pretty soon. But
That's exciting. Where can people learn more about that, Lloyd?
Well, when it's on my, I'll have it on my website when it's up.
Okay.
We're waiting for the web media company to tell us when they're getting it up. So it's just, we shot some stuff.
Right.
Some of it's fun. Some of it's more serious. So we'll see what happens, whether that goes anywhere. But I think that people need to really be aware, you know, to ask questions about the shows and just realize that most shows are entertainment shows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I think that's lost on a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. And frankly, I don't watch a lot of the paranormal shows because I don't find them entertaining.
I agree. I watch them under duress.
I check in every so often. And I'll watch an episode or two of a new show. If it's interesting, I'll watch it. But none of them so far have been of interest to me.
The historical locations are cool. And it certainly leads to more questions.
Yeah, no question.
You know, where is this? How do I get there? You know, is it available for booking? You know, blah, blah, blah. What's the history? So you have a number of different websites. You have a book coming out. I think I read that on Facebook.
Well, yeah, Haunted by Chocolate actually was going to be published I was going to get it out there myself.
Uh-huh.
But now I've picked up someone in New York who's representing it and wants to pitch it to the major publisher. So it's going to probably come out next year.
That's exciting. So people can follow you on Facebook. They
yep.
can contact...
They can find me on my website, mindreader.com.
Mindreader.com.
Or hauntedbychocolate.com.
Hauntedbychocolate.com. And they
want to follow me on Twitter. It's not that I post that often, but it's Prof mm-hmm. Paranormal. So
okay.
It's at Prof Paranormal.
Okay. And for those of you that haven't read any of Lloyd's books, they're available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble?
Right.
And your website, or no?
Yeah, they can get them on my website. If they want them autographed, I'll sell them to them.
Okay.
But
okay.
They'll be cheaper on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Okay. Any upcoming public appearances, Lloyd?
I am doing a small event at the Pioneer Saloon outside of Las Vegas on September 15th.
Okay.
Which is just pioneersaloon.info.info.
Okay.
And I'm also going to be speaking at the Forever Family Foundation's annual conference on spirit mediumship. This one's about science and spirit, which will be in Phoenix. And you can find out about that by going to www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org. This is an organization that is free to join. I highly encourage people to do that.
Okay.
It is an organization that supports mediumship work and mediumship research, scientific research. So it's a great organization. I'm on one of their advisory boards. That's going to happen at the beginning of November. They have a fundraiser event with Teresa Caputo, the Long Island medium, the night
mm-hmm.
before on the 9th, and we're going to be doing a conference on the 10th and 11th of November in Phoenix.
Good stuff, Lloyd. Good stuff.
Oh, and folks can find out about my classes on my website.
Oh, yeah, yeah, your classes. We kind of glossed over all of that. So you have, I don't want to belittle them by calling them enrichment classes, but
let's just say they're deeper than any course you're going to get otherwise. They're deep introduction courses to a number of different topics, one of which is investigations. One is the evidence for life after death. Another one is about being psychic, both the research we found about what makes the best psychics and the research that shows, you know, how to develop your abilities. I have a class on psychokinesis,
mm-hmm.
and then I have a class on theory and one on how parapsychology relates to other fields. And I'll be doing some other additional classes coming up as well.
Okay.
And they can get to them through my website right now or through hypnotherapytraining.com, since HCH Institute, where I teach, is mainly a hypnotherapy training class. Center.
Very cool. A researcher that actually gives back to the field, and it sounds like you're keeping busy and you're keeping out there researching as well.
You've tried to do that. Doing some other research with another colleague of mine, some mm-hmm. lab research coming up, but we try to do as much as we can, given one's life circumstances, and I do try to do education as much as I possibly can.
Well, Lloyd, I very much appreciate you spending your Sunday evening with myself, Phil, and my listeners. It was a pleasure to have you on, and thank you so much for taking the chance and getting back to me. I mean, for those of you that know me, I just contact people that have no idea who I am, and I figure the worst thing they can do is say no. But sometimes they say yes, like Lloyd did tonight.
You're very welcome.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking to you, and I look forward to working with you again, Lloyd.
Sounds great.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night, and the rest of you, until we meet again, stay haunted.
Lower your vibrations. Go raise arms. Say one of our names. Say your name again.
4, 3.
Hi, this is Dave Schrader from Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio. You're listening to 10 Renee Graham.
Thank you so very much.
This is Mike McDowell from the Indiana Ghost Crackers and Chaos Tours saying welcome to
the chaos. And get down with the sickness.
Yeah.
Say your name again.
Stop it.
Try again.
This is Jeff Belanger, and when I'm not out looking for ghosts, haunted places, and weird stuff all over the planet, I'm listening to Paranormal Radio with Renee Graham. I never miss a show, and if you miss a show, I swear I'll haunt you.
Thank you.
That's good. Paranormal Radio, taking you beyond the limits. Sundays, 6 to 7 p.m. Central.
Simulcast on SRN Live.